CGM 99.1 FM programming is hosted almost exclusively by community volunteers. The views and opinions expressed on the following program are that of the host and their guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of CGM FM. For more information and resources, visit our website at cjam.ca.
Hi, I'm Samantha, a past guest on CGM's Handy Link. You're listening to Handy Link on CJAM 99.1 FM, reaching high ground in Windsor, Detroit.
Welcome to Handy Link. I'm your host, Cam Wells. In this segment of our show, Dr. Gail Harrison will be telling us a little bit about congenital CMV. So, can you tell me a bit about your work with CMV?
Well, I have been working with CMV for about 40 years now. I study a variety of things dealing with the virus and its effect on people. I study its biology, its epidemiology, who gets it and under what circumstances. I study how to best diagnose it. I study the clinical manifestations of congenital CMV primarily, newborns who are born with the virus. I also study the long-term outcomes of congenital CMV because babies who are born with congenital CMV grow up and they become children, they become adolescents, they become adults. And so it is a lifelong infection that starts before birth. I also study treatments of CMV, antiviral treatments, functional therapies, hearing restoration, other therapies for mobility. I study that. And then I also study prevention, not necessarily vaccines themselves, but advocate for CMV awareness, because it is the most common virus most people never heard of, and also advocate for diagnostic testing, for interventions, for awareness, and for vaccine and other preventive programs so we can maybe reduce the burden of congenital CMV on humanity.
So what are some of the most common impacts of the virus?
So, it's a common virus, but for babies who are born with the virus, which is my main area, most babies actually are asymptomatic. No symptoms at all, and they grow up to be totally normal with normal hearing. However, if the virus does affect them, the most common sequelae or long-term outcome problem is hearing loss. And that hearing loss can be present at birth, and it can be total deafness, or it can be one-sided hearing loss, or it can be later in onset so that they're normal hearing at birth, but later on they can have hearing loss that's progressive. It's almost always progressive once it starts. So that's the most common, is hearing loss. CMV can also affect vision as well in a variety of ways. It can affect the brain, and that's a very important contributor to the long-term outcomes of congenital CMV, where individuals can have learning differences, seizure disorders, mobility issues, a whole host of long-term outcomes as well.
So with that host of ways it presents, is there ever a risk of misdiagnosis?
Yes. Congenital CMV, for example, is often underdiagnosed. occasionally overdiagnosed, but most of the time it's not diagnosed at birth because it can have a variety of symptoms. And patients can go on what we call a diagnostic odyssey, searching for the cause of their baby's hearing loss at birth or later onset hearing loss, or searching for the cause of their baby's microcephaly or seizures or abnormal neurologic exam or abnormal neurodevelopment. And that's primarily, I think, because we don't screen all babies for congenital CMV at birth. And so their infection is silent until it manifests.
So, in your research, has there been any success moment that stands out for you?
That's a very good question. I think there's some baby steps that have been taken with congenital CMV. One is improved diagnostics, so that when I started my research, we did traditional viral culture, which is very intense work. It was easy for me because I did it every day, but it wasn't something that was generalizable. So the development of a PCR molecular-based test for CMV diagnosis, even for congenital CMV, I think was very important in expanding the ability of anybody anywhere to diagnose congenital CMV, which is detection of the virus in the urine or the saliva or the blood in the first 21 days of life. So I think diagnostically that was a major impact. And actually, we published the first study of looking at CMV PCR diagnostics, applying it to the diagnosis of congenital CMV. And then it has exploded since then. So I think that was a baby step. Other baby steps have been introduction of antivirals to treat congenital CMV. Antivirals, however, do not cure congenital CMV. They take the edge off some of the problems. They can be very helpful acutely in the newborn period. They can also help a little bit with progressive hearing loss, to lessen that and improve developmental outcomes, but it's not a cure. So once again, a baby step. Another baby step in congenital CMV is awareness and prevention. We don't have a vaccine, but we do have awareness as far as how, say, women and individuals who are pregnant can reduce their risk of catching CMV while they're pregnant, to maybe reduce their risk of getting CMV while they're pregnant. So that's another baby step of just awareness. But as far as any earth-shaking triumphant successes with congenital CMV, I've been in this business for 4 decades, haven't seen any great breakthroughs, but we have made some baby steps.
I'd like to thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Okay.
In this segment of our show, Kathleen Brewer and Belinda Cobb will be telling us about the ECD Global Alliance. So what can you tell me about the Alliance?
So the ECD Alliance is a group of patients and family members who have been affected by a rare blood cancer called Erdheim-Chester disease. And the organization was began in 2009 when a few patients found each other online. We now include patients, families, clinicians, and researchers from around the world. We have about 900 patients from about 70 different countries. Our mission is to provide support to patients and families, to provide education and share information about ECD, and to support research.
So, what are the most common impacts of ECD?
So ECD can affect many different organs in the body, and each patient has a different set of organs that are affected. Most patients feel fatigue, and many experience pain in the bones of the legs and upper arms, and some have pain in other areas. Some of the more common issues that by no means every patient experiences, but some patients experience are extreme thirst and urination, which is known as diabetes insipidus. There's inflammation of blood vessels that some patients experience. Kidney involvement includes growth around the kidney, and it might look like a hairy kidney on a scan. Patients who have lung involvement may experience cough and shortness of breath. Some patients will see that they have a rash or yellow patches around their eyes, or their eyes may protrude out, and they may even have vision problems, like double vision. Patients who have neurological issues experience balance or swallowing issues, and they may also have emotional swings. So, without treatment, these issues can continue to progress and could lead to organ failure. But with successful treatment, progress can most often be halted. So it's very important for us to help patients receive a diagnosis as early in the progression of the disease as possible.
So I'm curious, with all the symptoms you described, is there ever a chance of misdiagnosis or the condition being mistaken for something else?
Absolutely. That's one of the big issues that we have with the organization, is trying to help patients get to a proper diagnosis. There's a couple of reasons why it's difficult. One is most doctors, in fact, never learn about this disease in medical school because it is so rare. So a doctor can't diagnose what they don't know. The other thing is that a diagnosis is difficult for a patient, even if the doctor is well aware of how to diagnose. The diagnosis requires patients to present with certain clinical symptoms that will actually alert a doctor that it may be ECD, and then there has to be radiological scans as well as pathology that is performed to arrive at a good diagnosis.
So, in your time with the Alliance, has there been any success story that stands out for you?
There are. I'm going to ask my colleague, Belinda Cobb, who is our patient navigator with the organization. She helps patients get the best care possible once they are diagnosed. And I'm going to ask her to talk about some of the accomplishments of the organization. Belinda?
So we've created a community which includes our patients, caregivers, and family, and also our medical professionals. Through this community, research is happening, and through this research, we now have two FDA-approved treatments. So we are very proud of the fact that we bring our community together through our yearly conference, and patients no longer have to feel alone. They have a community they can join virtually. We have funded $1.2 million in research, and we have a medical community that collaborates among themselves and the patient community. We also have a care center network of 34 worldwide, which half of them are in the United States.
So if you could send any message to the community about the need to keep pushing forward, what would you say?
What we would like to first of all is let any patient or family member or doctor who's been touched by ECD know that the ECD Global Alliance is here, and we're here to serve them. And if someone is searching for a diagnosis, they have issues they're dealing with that is eluding any diagnosis from the medical professionals, we'd like to tell them, please don't give up. Often there's someone in the world who can help them, that you just have to keep searching until you find the right person who can help.
Like,
from an ECD Global Alliance point of view, we'd like to to make sure that everyone knows that none of our work can be done without help. We're a very small organization, and organizations like ours always need the support of the community. We accomplish what we accomplish through donations and volunteers, and all of that is very much appreciated by us at the BCD Global Alliance.
I'd like to thank you both for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Yes.
HandyLink will be right back after these commercial messages, so stay tuned.
So you're hanging with your inner circle. Maybe you're making cocktails. Maybe you're packing bowls. Even while we're distancing, it's important to remember, alcohol and cannabis each mess with your driving skills. Be cool. Make sure you and your friends get home safe. Take a cab if you need to. A few bucks could save a life. And we can do it again next weekend. A message from Arrive Alive, Drive Sober.
Welcome back to HandyLink. I'm your host, Cam Wells. Earlier in our show, Dr. Gail Harrison told us a little bit about her work with CMV, and Kathleen Brewer and Belinda Cobb told us a little bit about the ECD Global Alliance. In this segment of our show, Kareem and Sarita Edwards will be telling us a little bit about the EWE Foundation. So, what can you tell me about the EWE Foundation?
So, the EWE Foundation is a healthcare advocacy organization. Its initial purpose, if you will, was to allow kind of a bereavement relief for families that had kids that perished or were not fortunate enough to live through or past birth, or some that have passed in utero. That was the initial thought of the EWE Foundation, but it has blossomed into so many more things since its inception.
So, in that sense, with the initial work about bereavement, I'd imagine there's a lot of mental health support goes into supporting families affected in this way.
Absolutely. So that's actually one of the things that we do for here locally. I know, and then my wife does a lot of things on a national stage as well in regard to mental health awareness, as well as education regarding mental health. She's actually a certified mental health instructor now, and that may not be the actual term or the actual title, but it is just that. More or less, she's an educator on mental health.
And just to chime in, hey, I joined a few minutes behind everybody, but I did want to chime in really quickly and say another thing in terms of just the organization itself. Like Kareem said, we started out really focused on bereavement support because that's the narrative associated with the diagnosis. But but we did learn quickly that there was an opportunity to provide some health literacy for families, but also try to bridge the gap between receiving a diagnosis like Edwards syndrome or trisomy 18 and how the healthcare system chooses to respond. And then just to kind of piggyback off what Kareem was saying in terms of our mental health support, we really saw an opportunity to raise awareness about the importance of finding the balance between caring for someone with a terminal illness or a medical complexity, medically complex diagnosis, and caring for yourself. A lot of our mental health focus is around being able to identify challenges that other children may be experiencing. So right now, our primary focus is multi-children households, because we understand and recognize that a lot of times you focus so much on the child with the medically complex diagnosis that you may miss something that one of your other children may be going through. And so our mental health program, it really promotes being able to recognize and identify a mental health challenge, and being able to know when some outside resources and support is needed. So I just wanted to chime in on that a little bit.
So
that's great.
How does the foundation go about reaching out to those affected who might potentially benefit from having that little bit of support in a medically complex time?
You know, so for us, you know, our target when we are putting up efforts to try to find families, we just raise a lot of awareness. We make sure we are active on our social media posts. We make sure we are active with our website. We do a lot of community outreach initiatives locally and across the country, so families can find us. You know, we really just try to talk about the services that we have, but also let families know that we have a lot of partner organizations that we work with very, very closely. So if we are not the resource, you know, we're still able to connect families with those resources. But we try to actively go into communities, whether virtually or in person. I think Kareem was saying about our local support. We work with our local school district. That's one way.
That's where it starts, kind of with the involvement through the city or the city's council and PTA, right? There's several functions or events that they host at different schools, and we make sure we're there. Even the local colleges here, when the opportunity presents, we are there at their trade shows or
their community outreach resource fairs. And you know, and one of the great things too, Cam, is a lot of times, you know, those folks reach out to us. You know, we may not have even heard about the community fair coming up, but they've heard about our resources. And one of the great things about trying to be as active as we are, people will reach out and say, you know, we're having this event, we'd love for you to be here. And so you know, that's a great way for us to reach some people who may not have heard of us before, or know about the services that we provide.
So in your time with the foundation, has there been any success story that stands out for you?
Any success stories? I would say, you know, one of our greatest successes, I would say, is being able to provide economic assistance to families living with trisomy 18, with the trisomy 18 diagnosis, which is our primary disease affiliation. One of our greatest successes is being able to meet the financial needs for families who might be experiencing financial hardship. We have done things from provide durable medical equipment to paying utility bills to, helping families commute back and forth between home and the hospital. Their infant is, you know, still in the NICU. And so that's a huge accomplishment, to be able to have the resources to be able to help those families. I don't know, Kareem, what would you say? I think that was the immediate thought that came to my mind.
So in terms of success stories, I'm hesitant to say the foundation itself is a huge success story, because you're talking two parents who were having their fifth kid by surprise, then was told that this kid was going to not live to see birth, and if he did live to see birth, he was going to perish shortly thereafter, and would probably not live to see his first birthday. That transitioned into, hey man, this is our fifth kid, so what about that mom or dad or those parents that are having their very first child, and they get this same news, and that's a tough place to be in, right? But then following that up with, we reached out to our insurance company, given the news that we had, and were told that, or found out, I guess, that the some insurance companies, the criteria is that you're not able to, they're not able to cover burial for this particular scenario. So so our initial was to see if we could scramble up some money to help the next family bury their kid in the event they were not able to financially. When that has transitioned into what we're talking about now, we're assisting people with mental health awareness, and my wife is educating on why mental health matters. We're connected with the National Suicide Prevention people, and several other global rare disease operations, doing work from a legislative standpoint, and all of that in conjunction with assisting with financial burden. We've done several projects as far as financial burden research project. We're now providing a place for major educational institutions to send interns to do internships and things of the next. So that would be my answer, I think, and I don't say that from a standpoint of arrogance, but a humble, grateful that we are able to position ourselves to help in so many different capacities. That would be my answer for the success story.
Like to thank you both for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Absolutely.
Thanks. What Kareem and Sarita were saying about the importance of mental health awareness is one of the vital aspects of disability life, especially in acquired conditions. Far too often, we grieve it as something that's gone, taken from us. The fact of the matter is, in any life, no matter the perceived loss, there's always hope and a way to rebuild. But the fact is, I maintain, and always have, disability is not necessarily a loss, but a new way of thinking. Now, things like bereavement and finding a way through, yes, that is something that is very, very difficult, but facing it alone will only make those challenges worse. Standing together, finding those in your community who can be a source of support, can be the absolute difference between letting that depression and grief consume you and finding hope in this world. And that's the key to any given condition, my friends. Finding that reason to take the next step forward. Maybe you won't find a cure immediately, but if you find steps in that direction, if you find ways to stand with others and give them your support, and in turn be supported, you'll find that life can be a little less of a dark, despair-filled place than you might think. In fact, you might even find strength in community. You might find people who can understand your situation and talk to you about it as ones with lived experience. This has been HandyLink. I'm your host, Cam Wells, reminding you we're all equal. So get on out there and have yourselves a good one. Something tells me you've earned it, folks. We'll see you next week.